Hey, welcome back to another episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcify and ISBA. I'm your host, Nathan Resnick, joined by my co-host, Aaron Alpeter. Aaron, how's it going today?
Doing good, Nathan. How are you?
Amazing. I'm excited to dive into Third Love, which is the topic and brand that we're covering on E-commerce on Tap. It's, you know, just an incredible e-commerce brand that's grown tremendously over the past, you know, 10 years almost. But before we dive into Third Love, do you want to give a quick overview of what e-commerce on Tap is for those that are listening for the first time?
Yeah, it's really the highlight of my week. I don't know about you, but what we do is we take a well-known, usually venture-backed company, tell their founding story, then reverse engineer their supply chain and talk about kind of what's ahead for them.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm excited to dive into this one. But before we dive in, what caught your eye this past week?
So two things, both in the shipping world. So the first thing is that there was a cat that ended up climbing inside an Amazon returns box and was shipped from Utah to California. Did you see this?
It's crazy.
Yeah. So they, I think the other part of the article is interesting is they were returning like 10 pairs of steel-toed boots. So the package weighed like 30 pounds or something like that. And the cat, I guess, crawled inside and they didn't notice it. The extra weight, taped it up, dropped it off, and were kind of looking for their cat. And then basically it opens up. The workers are like, hey, we don't ship cats. And so they ended up calling the person and saying, hey, we got your cat. They thought it was a prank initially, but they were able to get reunited. And the cat was fine. It was a little bit dehydrated, but was totally fine otherwise.
Wow, that is nuts. That is crazy.
And the other thing that I had was, and this is a little bit more on topic, is the post office is looking at making changes to their Workshare program. Are you familiar with the Workshare program?
I'm not.
So basically, it's how DHL e-commerce or Mail Innovations or SmartPost works. Basically, they are the ones that take the package from the fulfillment center. They are sorting to figure out which zip code it goes to. And then they use their network to basically turn that over to the post office really close to the delivery location. And so the thought is that they are sharing the work and therefore the post office is not incurring as much cost to do that. And that's been how that entire industry has been built. Well, what USPS is looking at doing is actually changing the economics so that it makes more sense for the post office to take possession of these packages further upstream as opposed to closer to delivery. And so that means that USPS will be the ones that are doing most of that routing and sortation. And so what that does is it actually makes their products, USPS products, more competitive. And so it's this really interesting thing to see what happens. But, you know, on one end of the spectrum, it's kind of benign. On the other end of the spectrum, it destroys DHL e-commerce, Mail Innovations, things like that, and just forces all this revenue through the post office.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, what caught my eye is, I guess, number one, Shein is looking to expand into toothpaste and skincare products. Now, you know, for me, I don't typically buy, you know, toothpaste or skincare that comes from, you know, China. So I think it's interesting to see that Shein is expanding categories. And I'm going to be curious to see how consumers, you know, accept or deny that expansion. Also, Outdoor Voices is on the verge of bankruptcy. I mean, Outdoor Voices was like the darling child of D2C for quite some time and just seems like it lost their way and, you know, had some internal troubles. But I think really the main gist of why they're on the verge of bankruptcy is they're over inventoried. And then General Mills made a big acquisition of a pet food brand, Edgar and Cooper, for an undisclosed sum. Edgar and Cooper is primarily in the European markets, and they reported over 100 million euros of sales in 2023. So interesting to see more of these kind of larger conglomerates continue to acquire brands that are doing, you know, 100 million plus in revenue. And there has been a lot of M&A action in kind of the pet food market in the past few years. So I thought that was pretty neat. But let's dive in. I mean, I guess to start, do you want to give a quick summary on what Third Love is?
Yeah, we're going to be digging into the undergarment industry today. So Third Love is an American company. They specialize in women's bras, underwear, loungewear, nightwear. And historically, the reason that they call themselves Third Love is historically you had two options. You had either a bra that was comfy but ugly or cute and scratchy. And so they've opted to create a third option that's both cute and comfy. And so that third option or Third Love. Company's headquartered in San Francisco, was founded in 2013. They've got around 100 to 200 employees. And as of this time last year, they had sold, I think, over 10 million bras, which is pretty phenomenal. And they're rumored to be doing a little over $200 million a year.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible story. So before we dive deeper into Third Love, let's talk about the industry, the bra market as a whole. So the bra market is supposed to reach $59.5 billion globally by 2023, and it's growing at 5.2% annually. Market trends have shown that more women are interested in comfort and having bras that are functional versus strictly lingerie. E-commerce and online purchasing is also considered to be an industry trend. So, you know, primarily in the past, you know, people would go into a retail location to actually, you know, buy bras, but that's definitely changed a lot in the past 5 years. And the sports bra segment held the highest market share in 2022, which is interesting because it's probably the newest category within the bra market. And it's really about the doll functionality. And I think the kind of growth in this whole athleisure type of market in general, in terms of, you know, people wearing kind of more athleisure type of products. But by raw material, the cotton segment held the highest market share in 2022, accounting for nearly 2/5 of the global bra market. And this means they're, you know, breathable, natural cotton that makes it ideal for everyday wear. And it's the most popular type of bra. So some key trends in the competitive landscape of the global bra market. Number one, increasing focus on innovation. There's more and more players coming to market with innovations in bras. For example, some players are developing bras with new features such as wireless support and temperature control. And number two is they're expanding distribution channels. So they're, you know, going across for a wider reach of consumers. For example, opening new stores in different, you know, areas of the country and expanding their online presence. So I think it's interesting to, you know, look at the industry from a bird's eye view. But really, I don't think we could talk about Third Love without talking about, you know, the largest player in the market, which is Victoria's Secret.
Yeah, so let's just start with their history. And like you said, I think it's impossible to talk about really any bra startup without talking about Victoria's Secret. Victoria's Secret was started in 1977. It was started by someone named Roy Raymond, headquartered in San Francisco. And the brand was really a response that Roy had to the lack of sophisticated lingerie options that he felt were available for men to shop for their partners. And so it was very interesting. This theme will come up where it was intentionally, it was a store that sold to women, but it was really for men. And they found that, you know, his experience and what he had seen is that men were really uncomfortable going into lingerie shops. He felt that this was the underserved market. And so he wanted to make places that were comfortable for men and for men magazines and clothes and things like that. And the company did about $500,000 in revenue its first year and paid off all of its initial debt. And in 1982, Les Wexner, who founded and controls Limited Brands, or now known as L Brands, he joined Victoria's Secret as a partner and bought in for about $1 million. And Victoria's Secret had about 6 stores and $6 million a year in revenue at that point. And the investment by Les Wexner and L Brands meant that the company could grow both financially and from a marketing perspective. And so they were able to transform themselves from just a regional San Francisco-based shop to a national brand. Although everything was not well in paradise, there was a lot of friction between Roy and Les, to the point where Roy decided to sell the entire company to Les Wexner for $4 million. And Lex was shocked because he thought the amount was super low. And Roy thought that he could outgun Les Wexner and he could outgrow Victoria's Secret with his own business acumen. But Lex was like, all right, fine. If you want $4 million, here's $4 million. I probably would have paid double or triple that, but here's $4 million. And so after the sale in 1984, Roy Raymond went and founded My Child's Destiny, which is a high-end children's toy store. But that company filed for bankruptcy and only 2 years later in 1986. And Roy's life really wasn't the same since he sold to Les Wexner. He had lots of financial failures with this venture, with other ventures. He lost all of his money. His relationship with his wife deteriorated. He lost his wife by 1993. And he became very depressed. And unfortunately, all this was kind of too much for him. And he jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge in 1993.
Wow, that is crazy. I mean, you think about how Victoria's Secret is this powerhouse and how its founder committed suicide. I mean, that is just crazy. I don't think many people know that story. And it's just insane. And it goes to show, you know, sometimes as a founder, you might have one wild, successful business and think you can go into a different vertical and start something else. And, you know, it doesn't turn out to be the way that you thought it would. And yeah, I had never heard the story of Roy Raymond, and it's truly just saddening to hear that he committed suicide. But, you know, it shows the history of Victoria's Secret. And I wonder too, you know, would Roy have been able to grow it to the scale that it is today without that partnership with L Brands?
You know, it's hard to say. We're going back 50 years at this point. I would guess not. I mean, Les Wexner is probably one of the greatest retail merchandising gurus that's ever lived, right? And so he's built so many different brands, whether it be the Limited, Bath & Body Works, Abercrombie & Fitch, of course, Victoria's Secret. And so it's really something where I think that Les Wexner made Victoria's Secret what it is today and kind of the platform he was able to plug things into, but certainly wouldn't have been started without Roy's involvement. But kind of going back to the history of the company. So in 1995, Victoria's Secret started their famous fashion show that was held in New York. And in 1999 was the first time that was broadcasted online. And so it was one of the first large scale events that was streamed online, live on the internet. It's weird to think that 1999, the first streaming thing was then, and we're only, you know, a couple of decades removed, and we're able to stream as much as we can. But basically from 2000 to 2010, this was really the pinnacle, the heyday of Victoria's Secret. And the brand, powered by its angels or supermodels, expanded its product lines to include beauty, products, swimwear, apparel. And by 2010, it was the dominant force in the lingerie industry. It had leading market share. It occupied the mid to high end of the market from a pricing perspective. And they set the tone, right? So the industry was characterized by very glamorous and heavily marketed, heavily photoshopped types of things for a very specific type of woman. They had limited sizing, limited styles, and the marketing was usually sexualized. Again, going back to those roots where Victoria's Secret, even though women are their customers, they're really selling to men and you know, what the lingerie could mean for that. They were predominantly brick and mortar. Online wasn't really a thing in 2010. And they kind of were running into some issues with the way that the brand depicted some women. There's been a lot of research and kind of things that have come out about just the impact that the perfect image that Victoria's Secret put out had difficulties or caused harm to women, their self-esteem, their body images, things like that. But 2010, they were generating about $5.5 billion in revenue.
I mean, it's incredible to hear the size and scale of Victoria's Secret. And, you know, to give context, Third Love, which is, you know, kind of a D2C darling brand that so many people admire, is estimated to do about $200 million in revenue. So it's really, I mean, such a small scale compared to where Victoria's Secret's at, but it goes to show that Third Love has a lot of room to grow. And I think it's interesting, you know, as we dive into Third Love, to learn about the origin story in terms of who the founders are. So Heidi Zak is the CEO of Third Love. She's also the founder, and she grew up in Youngstown, New York. And her introduction to business was working at a small general store. She spent most of her youth in competitive gymnastics and realized that she wasn't going to compete in college. And so ended up going to Duke University without ever visiting, which is kind of a fun fact. I feel like so many people, you know, spend time visiting their universities. But she loved her time at Duke, was a tour guide, and initially thought she wanted to be a lawyer. So she majored in economics and poli-sci and participated in their entrepreneurship program. After university, she moved to New York City and was working as an investment banker at Bank of America, focused on retailers for about 2 years. Then she took a role at McKinsey for 2 years, again, focused on retail. So, you know, it is interesting that her background as a banker was really focused on retail, which I think will come to play later in Third Love's story. But she enjoyed covering the sector and longed to get into the operator side of things. So as she was a banker, she did have that desire to, you know, become an operator of one of these brands at one point. And she then decided to go to business school. So she went to business school at MIT to kind of reset her career trajectory. And that's where she met her now husband, David Spector. And they together led the graduate retail club. And she got kind of nervous because going into the summer, she didn't have an internship lined up in April for the summer. So while everyone else had consulting or finance internships, she and her co-founder of the retail club would, you know, basically spend nights cold calling retailers that they knew would hire last minute. And she got connected to the head of HR at Aeropostale, who said that their head of strategy was looking for a summer intern. So she ended up working at Aeropostale, you know, after this internship for a few years on their new business initiatives and Marcus team. So, I mean, what do you think would have happened had she not been as committed seeking out her own internship? Because it, to me, it seems like she has this background in history and retail, then wants to get to the operator side and gets to work at, you know, one of the largest retail brands, Aeropostale, for a few years because she goes out and seeks this internship.
Yeah, it kind of echoes to me the previous episode we did about Athletic Greens and Chris Ashenden and really this idea of taking ownership and not letting life just happen to you. And so I think that this really just goes to show who she was and why she was wired to be a founder, even if that wasn't something that she had planned on. And, you know, had she not been willing to spend hours and go seek out people who may want an intern and, as opposed to waiting for people to come to campus and look for her, you know, it's possible she may have attempted to take another job or she may not have had an internship. But you always have to respect people that go out and make their own luck.
Definitely. I think it's a key part of the story. And, you know, this is kind of how they stumbled into starting Third Love. So Heidi wanted to move to San Francisco. She ended up taking a job at Google where her now husband was also working. And David eventually found his way to Sequoia Capital. But, you know, I think this goes to show the culture of San Francisco in terms of it being so entrepreneurial friendly and entrepreneurial driven. They were both really encouraged by their friends who were starting companies. And so they thought, you know, why not us? Why shouldn't we start our own company? And so they started looking at different ideas, you know, trying to pick each other's brains and see what would stick. And so one day Heidi needed a new bra. And so she did what she'd done since she was a preteen. She drove to the mall and went to Victoria's Secret. And she didn't really want to engage with the workers there. She grabbed 25 different bras and tried them on, found one that kind of fit, and then bought it and left. And as she looked at the pink striped bra on her hands, she actually put it inside a tote bag that she was carrying because she was embarrassed by this like bright pink bra. And so she went home and looked online for a brand that, you know, she thought the modern woman would want to wear. And she was surprised that nothing existed. You know, most bras on the market at the time were very vibrant, standout colors. And she didn't feel like there was a bra that fit this kind of modern woman. And so she realized that this could be a gap in the market. And so she told David that she may have found their idea. He was initially very skeptical, but most men would be, not knowing about the bra market, and told her all the reasons why this wouldn't work. David had co-founded a few startups in the past and seen many more opportunities at Sequoia. And I think it goes to show this kind of dynamic of trying to understand, how do you know when this idea is good, right? I mean, Aaron, we've both started different companies in the past. What kind of tells you, or what do you determine makes an idea good?
I think for one is it doesn't go away. Despite knowing the worst case scenario, despite knowing how much work it's going to be, despite the fact that you know what you're up against, if you still go through that and recognize that, hey, it's not going away, then that's where it's generally a good idea. And, you know, at least for me, how I think about these sorts of things is I then start to invest time, maybe some money, to explore it. And at the very beginning, I'm looking for a reason to kill the idea. And if you can't find a compelling reason in the idea, then you kind of move forward, and then it becomes a question of, can you execute? The ideas are important, but the execution is so much harder.
Yeah, and that's what Heidi and David, you know, really did. They started to evaluate this idea, tear it apart, and eventually they contemplated leaving their jobs to pursue it full time. Their ultimate question to themselves was, would we regret not doing this? And the answer was yes. So, you know, they really, to alleviate those concerns that their family had for quitting their jobs, they kind of put themselves and asked, well, what's the worst case scenario here, right? They go back and get other jobs at Google and Sequoia, you know, after this. And so, you know, they felt comfortable with that worst case scenario. And so they quit their jobs and invested $50,000 into this idea and went to work on it in 2013. So the first thing they did was hire someone that knew about bras as their third co-founder, Rael Cohen. And Rael had an Associates of Arts in Fashion Design from the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising. And prior to co-founding Third Love, she had more than 10 years of experience in the fashion industry, leading creative and product departments for other fashion brands, leveraging her experience. So I think it goes to show, like, you know, Heidi and David, they were not necessarily fashion experts, but they brought in that third co-founder that had that experience in fashion design, which I think, you know, as we realize and discover, is vital to the Third Love success.
Yeah, completely.
So now that the founding team has been assembled, how did they get started, Aaron?
Yeah, well, they start out by talking to lots of women. And what they recognized pretty quickly was that most women were wearing bras that didn't really fit right. And through some later research that they've done, they estimated that over 35% of women are wearing the wrong bra size. And actually that a woman's breast size is in shape is going to change 6 times throughout their life. And so they said, okay, we've got to solve this fit problem. That's really our entry into doing something that's truly going to be better and not just different than what Victoria's Secret is doing. And so with their seed money, they raised a small seed round. They focused on building out an app, and they had this app that helped women find their perfect fit, and ultimately decided to do something that was very radical. And that was to sell in half sizes. Rather than an A, B, C, they've got A and a half, B and 3/4, things like that. And it kind of makes sense if you think intuitively in the sense of shoe sizes. If I, you know, I wear a 10 and a half, and there's a very big difference between a 10 and an 11. And so that's the same sort of thing with bras and breast shape and sizes. They have this idea, they have this concept, and to test their physical product and to iterate, they actually found over 100 women on Craigslist that were willing to come to an apartment in San Francisco, try these on, and give feedback in what worked and what didn't work. And so they gave them gift certificates for free product when they launched. But they did this because they didn't really have enough money, but they still recognized how important it was to do testing and to get that user feedback. And this qualitative and quantitative information was really what went into developing those specs. And it took the better part of 1 or 2 years to really nail the product.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I would answer an ad like that on Craigslist, you know, even if it was for shoes or something that I really, you know, enjoyed and admired. I mean, it is interesting to see how they really focus on product development from the early stages. And I think that's what set Third Love apart, right? Because, you know, no other bra brand was innovating on sizing and their fit. And so I think it's really goes to show how important that third co-founder was to making this happen, because, you know, that was probably a pretty unique insight when they looked at the market in terms of understanding, well, how can we, you know, make this the quote unquote, you know, perfect fit for our customers. And so they did this by iterating and testing the product with over 100 people that, you know, they didn't know, which I think goes to show when you want product, best product feedback is going to come from people you don't know, right? So get out in the real world, test your product with real people.
Yeah, for sure. And they focused on this fit piece, and that was going to be what they had to do. And so they took their seed round, they built their mobile app, and initially their entire website from scratch. And there were some interesting things that they were dealing with as they were trying to raise money and trying to get going. The first one is there were a lot of investors that didn't believe that women would want to buy a bra online. And it seems kind of antithetical to where we are today, but this was a product that was experienced. It was tried on. And so they just said, hey, your returns are going to be ridiculous. And so their answer to that was really investing heavily in the fitting technology. And that was enough to kind of get some investors on board to say, okay, here's how we're going to do it. And the other part too is, I thought it was interesting, it's just a side note, that they built their own front end, so their own shopping cart, their own web page, all those sorts of things. And this was because in 2013, Shopify really wasn't mainstream. They eventually transitioned to Shopify in 2015, and they're now one of the bigger stores there. But this was all kind of happening as they're launching the business and getting going. Oh, and by the way, Heidi and David had their first kid. And so talk about kind of a stressful time and doing lots of things at once. Here they are launching a company, trying to effectively do something that hadn't quite been done before, and their new parents.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. I mean, they had so much going on, and I can only imagine how emotionally draining the first 2 years of business are, because number one, new brand, no one knows about Third Love. Number two, women in general weren't used to buying bras online. And so it was something that they really had to craft the new experience around. And, you know, they literally had an investor tell them to just give up. You know, this business is clearly not working. But in 2015, they gathered 10 or so people at the company and said, you know, we've got to figure this out. You know, there wasn't too much to speak of from the 2 years of work they had put in. And so they started whiteboarding all the ways they could make this a no-brainer. And their distribution became a key part of their success. They launched this Try Before You Buy program that gave you the bra for 30 days before you had to buy it. And you only had to pay for the return shipping if you did not like it. So this really helped instill and build trust with a customer base that was just getting to know them. And this was a major unlock for them and really enabled them to start to grow rapidly. I mean, not many companies at this time were doing like a try before you buy type of program. And so it was really innovative for Third Love to launch this.
Yeah. And it comes back to the fact that they believed in their product so much. They knew from customer feedback that when women wore the bra, they loved it. But the problem was, is that not many people were buying it. And so they really took the step back to say, how do we make this a no-brainer opportunity and just, you know, get it to the point where we know you're going to love this. Just try it. Just that's all we want to do is just try it. And I think back to, you know, Athletic Brewing or Vuori or any of the other companies that we've covered where they're like, just, you know, I can't explain it. You know, Facebook ads don't do it justice. Just try it. And this is something that really was a bit of a gamble, and it was kind of a bet the company sort of moment. Because what they were doing wasn't working. They were burning through their cash. They were making dozens of dollars a day. I mean, Heidi talks about stories where, you know, there were days where they didn't have any orders. And imagine being a young e-commerce company and you're going 3 or 4 days without a single order. And then maybe on the fourth day you get one order and you're like, yeah, this is not going to be a viable thing. And so they bet the company, and this could have backfired enormously just from a cash flow perspective if they had outlaid all of this inventory, right? They outlaid the cash for the inventory. Then they had basically given it to a consumer. And if a consumer didn't like it, it came back. And so you're kind of way upside down from a cash point of view. But I think this really goes into their fitting tech and how they were able to limit the amount of returns that they would get because they had such a great personalization flow to make sure that when the consumer ordered the product, it was the right product for them. And they were able to do well that way.
Yeah. I mean, how did they reduce returns with their fitting tech, right? Because like their bras are so specific in size compared to the general market. And a lot of women weren't used to these, you know, new sizes that Third Love put into place. I mean, what really encompassed their fitting tech to reduce returns?
Yeah, they probably have one of the best personalization flows that's out there. And they have an online fitting room, and they have tens of millions of women that have gone through this fitting room. But it asks very specific questions, and you provide a lot of data in return about your physique and kind of where you are in life and things like that. And with that information, Third Love is able to suggest the best size for you and provide different options for you to choose from. And so this actually results in most women being suggested different sizes than what they were used to. And this can be a little bit jarring because someone may think that they're a B cup, but they're actually a C cup or an A cup or things like that. And so this really is something that they are able to size in and say, okay, here's exactly what you need. They send it to you. And more often than not, it's a home run. And so this is really something that has really been the unlock, because anybody can do a try before you buy, right? You just have to have enough cash and inventory. But in apparel, which already has high returns, you're kind of inviting the fox into the hen house, so to speak, and just saying, yeah, we want more returns. This isn't Rent the Runway, right? And so they're doing all of this work up front to make sure that when you do get something, they have focused on exactly the type of product that you need. And their whole ethos and their focus with this fitting store and with their customer service is they want to basically position themselves as your best friend that happens to be an expert on bras. And so this is really kind of how they go out and do that.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I think one thing that I love about Third Love as well is they leaned into a international development team, right? So, you know, everyone knows Bay Area developers can be extremely expensive. And so at this start stage to lean into efficiency, you know, of the development of their apps and technology, they actually created their software engineering team in Cordoba, Argentina. And so this is where they hired all their engineers in software development that really, you know, made this fitting technology come to play and really reduce their returns. So it was pretty incredible to see what they did. I mean, Third Love, you know, started breaking ground and really innovating across every sector. So number one, we talked about them selling bras online with a virtual fitting room. Number two, their Try Before You Buy program. Number three, using real women in their marketing campaigns, which was extremely different than Victoria's Secret that had their fashion show and was really trying to, you know, quote unquote, mold this ideal woman. And they used real women, which people loved. You know, this really made them stick out from a marketing standpoint and being extremely inclusive for all women of shapes, different sizes, ethnicity, you name it. And it goes to show from their revenue, right? Because they ended up doing $1 million in revenue in 2015 and then grew to $66 million in revenue in 2017 and $109 million in 2018. So I think it's just incredible to see their growth and really them firing on all cylinders when it comes to, you know, great marketing campaigns, great technology that's going to lower returns, and just efficiency when it comes to the development of these different, you know, verticals that help them grow.
Yeah, absolutely. They kind of went from being worried, are we going to be around anymore, to now thinking about the world that they wanted to operate in. And they were given a great opportunity to basically make a statement by Victoria's Secret. And so in 2018, the CMO of Victoria's Secret, who happened to be a man, gave an interview to Vox, which is basically a hit piece on Third Love. He talked about how Victoria's Secret is not someone's third love. We are their first love. And that was the basic title of the article. And so his comments really came off as tone deaf, but also indicative of kind of how Victoria's Secret was thinking about things at the time. He talked about how they had tried plus size models in the early 2000s and people didn't like it, and talked about how they would never have a trans model, or that the fashion show is really entertainment for women and that women love it. And this article came out on, say, a Friday, and that week his phone's being blown up as different people are reaching out to her and saying, hey, did you see this? And she and her team felt like the message in the world that Victoria's Secret was creating really didn't represent the women that they knew or the world that they wanted to live in. And so only days after the article was published, they ran a full page ad in the Sunday edition of the New York Times. And the ad was structured as an open letter from Heidi to Victoria's Secret. And in it, she called the Victoria's Secret CMO comments demeaning and disrespectful to women, and basically just kind of gave their manifesto effectively. This is after they had started a campaign to boycott the Victoria's Secret's fashion show, and they launched an online petition together with a model who was a well-known plus size model. And so this was very much on brand with them. They had this huge opportunity, kind of like Blenders and Deion Sanders and the Colorado State story that we shared. But they got enormous press attention and got a huge amount of goodwill from consumers because of this. And so this was kind of the right moment and ended up being a very good thing for them. But kind of my question for you is, when is it wise to pick a fight with Goliath?
Yeah, I mean, I love this. I love the strategy that Third Love put into place against Victoria's Secret. I think they got a ton of attention for this and it worked well for them. You know, they continue to grow. I think when it comes to picking a fight with a Goliath and using it as a marketing strategy to grow, I mean, especially when that Goliath responds, you're going to get so much attention. So I think the key is making sure, number one, you can't get any legal trouble for it. So the Goliath can't, you know, sue you for something that you might have said that might be false about them. So I think that's number one, making sure that your lawyers approve of what you're going to, you know, do and say from a marketing standpoint. And I think number two, when you see a Goliath slip up like this, you have to move quickly and swiftly and make a strong statement, bold statement. And that's exactly what Third Love did. So hats off to, you know, their marketing team and whoever implemented this at the time, because I really do think they took a great approach to Victoria's Secret's, you know, slip up, and just, you know, goes to show their CMO really didn't know who their customer is.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because it sounded like they started the fight a little bit by trying to get people to boycott the fashion show. But Victoria's Secret, I think in this case, definitely fired the first shot by having that hit piece out that talked about how they're not someone's third love, they're their first love. And so, you know, part of it is, I don't know if Goliath picked a fight with them or they picked a fight with Goliath, but I think they responded wonderfully. And, you know, it's kind of funny because there are some brands out there that might be like, hey, yeah, you know, we're about to launch and let's go yell at Amazon or let's go yell at Walmart for doing something bad. And at that point, you're just not credible. Like, it's not worth doing. And so you kind of have to be at the right level of scale where it actually means something, where they know who you are, right? And they see you as a competitor versus just a brand. And so I think, it's an interesting thing to see the stars align that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was pretty incredible in terms of how they got so much attention, this kind of back and forth with Victoria's Secret. It was amazing. And Third Love has ran into a little controversy. You know, former employees did speak out against the company and David specifically for creating a difficult work environment in 2019. And so David, you know, stepped away from active management in the company in 2022. But they've continued to grow. So they started opening retail stores in early 2020 with, you know, COVID. Obviously, that wasn't the best timing. And so they had to conduct some layoffs and sales slowed down, you know, during COVID because of that retail expansion that they missed time because of the pandemic. But since the pandemic, they've continued to open up stores and offer a kind of personalized one-on-one fitting meeting with an expert, which I think is a pretty great way to continue to build customer loyalty. And they continue to innovate with products. So they've continued to grow pretty tremendously. Do you want to give kind of a timeline milestone update of Third Love starting in 2013, Aaron?
Sure. Yeah. So 2013, the company was founded in San Francisco, and they were able to raise a $5.6 million seed round that was led by NEA. In 2015, again, this is after they've gone through all the product stuff and they are kind of just doing their try before their buy, they were able to cross $1 million in revenue, which, again, it's $1 million. I would love to have $1 million a year in like a paycheck. But for all intents and purposes, this was a very, very rough, very long time to get to your first million. So I can understand why some investors said, hey, this maybe isn't going to work. In 2016, they had a Series A of $8 million that was led by NEA. And in 2017, they had their first significant milestone, so $66 million in revenue. In 2018, the company became profitable, and they had $109 million in revenue. In 2019, they raised their Series B. It's about $55 million, led by Allen & Company. And they had quite a few well-known women that were investors. So they had Susan Wojcicki, YouTube CEO, Katie Couric, Tim Armstrong, not a woman, but AOL CEO, invested in there. And so here they are kind of squarely in that $100 million revenue range. In 2020, with the pandemic, they had to lay off about 30% of their workforce. And they actually saw their business slow down. So they dropped prices somewhat aggressively in order to increase their online sales. In 2021, they had an undisclosed venture round led by Halogen Ventures. I know that team. Jesse Draper is fantastic. Third Love also decided to launch into sportswear. And so they launched sports bras in 2021. In 2022, they had their first acquisition where they acquired a company called Kit Undergarments, which allowed them to expand further into the underwear segment. And in 2023, they were in swimwear. They just dipped their toe in that. And they are starting to launch on Amazon to leverage the delivery speeds and resources. And so it looks like they're leveraging Amazon from a fulfillment perspective, which is interesting to see a brand that large that's doing that. And again, their estimated revenue in 2023 is about $222 million.
It's pretty incredible. I mean, what sticks out to me on the timeline is just how long it took them to get to $1 million in revenue. I mean, most e-commerce brands that raise that size of a seed round are pushing for $1 million in revenue very quickly. I mean, you know, less than 6 months, and it took them, you know, a long time to get to that revenue milestone. So that's what really stuck out to me. And it also is a bit surprising that they had to conduct major layoffs during COVID. I mean, I think in general, right off the bat, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic was a shock for many and disrupted so many supply chains that, you know, there was a lot of layoffs right off the bat in COVID, but most brands grew tremendously during COVID, and Third Love did as well, but, you know, just in a different way, it seems.
Yeah. Well, even just going back to your comment about the $1 million, if you've got $5.5 million, you can spend to get $1 million in revenue, right? And I think that just goes to show maybe how capital inefficient they were at the beginning. And they had all of this R&D costs. They had all these things that were going in. So it's possible that their war chest just wasn't there, right?
Yeah. And I mean, with COVID, there were so many supply chain issues, and, you know, I didn't know too much about bra manufacturing before diving into Third Love, but bra manufacturing is still incredibly manual. I mean, it's pretty crazy, but Aaron, can you guess how many different pieces of fabric or material goes into your average bra?
I wouldn't even have a clue.
It's pretty remarkable. It's 30 different pieces and has 17 different hand sewing operations that need to be done. So this is a very intensive product to make and incredibly manual. So it is pretty crazy to dive into their supply chain. And as you can imagine, having half cup sizes requires a ton of extra inventory and SKUs. So, you know, from a supply chain perspective, there's a ton going on with sizing because Third Love has these half cups, which was, I think, a great approach from a product standpoint, but just makes it even more complex when it comes to inventory and SKUs. So as a basic company, you know, they really, you know, are not necessarily constrained or affected by their trends or fashions, but, you know, they do try to innovate as much as they can. And so when it comes to their factory base, they, you know, started off in Mexico because it was close to California where they lived, and they thought this would be beneficial. The on-demand piece was huge because it didn't make it so they had to keep cash in inventory, which is a huge burden for every brand. But, you know, this manufacturing partner was not necessarily eager to help them with their challenges and kept pushing back against the improvements that they wanted to make on the product because, you know, the manufacturer thought the customer just would not care. And the factory was also not focused on costs and not paying attention to details and quality that they thought were key to the product. So they ended up importing, you know, over $400,000 worth of raw material that they had to write off. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think about, you know, a lot of people in today's world want to shift production to Mexico. You know, starting off in Mexico can be extremely challenging, and even trying to scale operations there can be. How do you think about that decision as you, you know, look back on this story where Heidi and David, you know, decided, hey, let's start manufacturing in Mexico?
I think it was the right strategy, but the wrong execution. You know, I kind of always go back to what I call the Xbox model and how Microsoft initially launched the Xbox. And what they did is they started by putting their manufacturing base in Mexico because they needed to be reactive. They wanted to shorten that timeline. They didn't know where the inventory was going to go, how much they were going to sell. And so they started and did that. And then as they scaled with the second, third year of the Xbox, that's when they moved their manufacturing over to Asia to take advantage of the lower cost pieces there. And so I think it's a brilliant thing to do when you're just trying to launch a product. You don't really know where the demand's going to be, and you want to reduce your inventory. I think it's smart. The problem that they had is they found somebody who just said yes, and they didn't take the opportunity to take a step back and say, is this the right partner for us? Do they understand what we're trying to do and what we want to be able to do? To be basically not launched and to have to write off, you know, was it 8%, 9% of your seed round in inventory because you made the wrong choice on a factory? That is difficult to swallow.
Yeah, it definitely is. And so they went to China, and, you know, even manufacturing bras in China is not easy because the MOQ is super high. So about 3,000 units per size, which is a lot to start off with. And a lot of these manufacturers in China didn't want to work with them because they were, you know, using these half cup sizes, which, you know, they weren't used to before. So they had to pitch so many manufacturers before they were actually admitted by one. And most of them were turned off because they had different sizes and half cup sizes. And many of these brands were already producing for major brands and were just unsure about working with a startup. And it's what a lot of startups face when they go to find a manufacturing partner in China. Number one, you know, there's challenges meeting MOQs. Number two, you know, it's really hard to forecast. Number three, usually you're doing something innovative from a product standpoint. So you actually have to go in and pitch these manufacturers, these factories to accept you, basically, which most people don't realize. Most people think you just show up to a factory that's already producing your product and, you know, oh yeah, we want more business, so we'll accept you. But they don't realize there's a lot that goes into every product when it comes to manufacturing it, and especially with bras. So they eventually found a partner in Asia that not only shared their vision, but helped them with R&D. You know, one example of this is making their bra tags less scratchy, which was a great innovation.
Yeah. I mean, I can't underscore how important having the right manufacturing partner is and the right relationship. And again, yes, you need capabilities, you need the economics to work, but having somebody who is in tune with what you're trying to do and is going to be an active and willing participant in the creation of that outcome is just so important.
Yeah. What does their international strategy look like? Are they shipping abroad right now? What does that look like?
They are. When I dug into it, I was actually surprised that they weren't doing more of this and that they weren't doing it better. So they do ship to 37 countries outside the U.S., but it's kind of very much of a, hey, we're a U.S. company, we'll ship overseas, and like you'll have to wait for it. So it's one of these things where I think that this is a good opportunity for them. In some cases, it's like, if you're not going to do international well, don't do it. But I think there's some very small things that they could do that would allow them to ship faster, make the returns better, and basically just give it a little bit more of a localized experience versus just a Canadian ordering something from the US and having to wait, 2 weeks for it to cross the border.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I will say on the returns front, I do like for their customers that they're offering a 60-day refund window, which is great, and that they actually donate these returns to women's shelters versus destroying these garments like a lot of other providers or companies do in the industry. So I thought that was a plus. Let's talk about their exit strategy, right? Because earlier in this episode, you heard us talk about the size and scale of Victoria's Secret. Third Love is growing. They're profitable. They control their own destiny. What does their exit strategy look like?
Yeah, Aaron? So today, Third Love is the third largest underwear brand in the U.S. So they're following Victoria's Secret and American Eagle. And so that is a huge accomplishment. The fact that they're number three with these two very well-established public companies is pretty awesome. They are profitable, which means that they control their own destiny. And they have value to an acquirer should someone want to buy them. Their strategy right now appears to be that they're going to expand into different categories. So loungewear, underwear, swimwear, sportswear. They want to do more of that versus selling more of the same products and either having deeper penetration in the U.S. or expanding geographically. On one hand, run the risk of splitting their focus and only having mediocre performance or mediocre products if they don't execute well. On the other hand, if they are able to do this well, they gain the benefit of creating a master brand like a Victoria's Secret that could eventually expand into virtually anything. And so it's one of these things where you look at this and it was probably much easier for them to say, all right, let's go international, or let's go deeper, maybe do more into retail than trying to create the master brand strategy. But maybe they feel like they want to do the hard part first and they want to leave international expansion on the table for an acquirer. I think all that being said, they still have plenty of room to grow in the U.S. Victoria's Secret sold over $6 billion in 2023. So Anna, what's your thought on this whole, should they go international, should they go deeper into retail, or should they try to create a master brand?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some easy international wins that they could implement, like, Canada and maybe opening up a fulfillment center in Europe as well. I mean, there's some international expansion they could do to and still leave room on before an acquirer. So for me, I would probably lean to that, especially in Canada. But, retail in general can hurt, especially, when you're distributing your products across, all your different retail locations that are, owned by Third Love and have to be operated by Third Love as well. So I think that's even harder to do in my perspective. But, maybe that's because I know supply chain and like the logistics of dealing with international shipping and international expansion. So maybe it's just that their team isn't suited yet to expand internationally. What do you think about potential acquirers? I mean, I don't see Victoria's Secret being a buyer here, but I mean, what do you
think? I agree with you. I think that they have been too much of the boogeyman and they've really built their brand around pushing back on Victoria's Secret. And so I think that to some extent, there will be a portion of their consumers that push back and say, hey, like, we thought you were the anti-Victoria's Secret. Why did you sell out? Right? I think that would be the narrative. I think, a few years ago, you could have looked at Walmart as an acquirer. This seems to be the kind of brand that they were interested in when they were, buying Elbows and all the other brands. But they have since unwound those. They've sold those brands, kind of all to the same private equity company over the last 10 years. You think about this, and as a standalone business, it probably fits nicely inside the portfolio of a PVH. So the folks that own Calvin Klein or Inditex, which owns Zara, those two brands have relationships in China, and they could take it internationally very, very quickly. And so I think that's something that would make a lot of sense. And this idea to maybe not go international makes a whole lot of sense if you're trying to hold that in reserve for an acquirer, because they'd be probably willing to increase the multiples to some extent because they know that they can triple the size of the business by going into China, going into Europe, et cetera. I think that you could also throw L Brands in there. So kind of full circle. So this is Les Wexner's company, L Brands. They previously owned Victoria's Secret, but they actually spun out Victoria's Secret. So technically Victoria's Secret is separate from L Brands. And so that could be an interesting thing for them to acquire. But right now, with everything that we've been able to see, they're really focused on an IPO, which means that they're going to have to figure out that international strategy themselves.
Yeah, I mean, they're, you know, founder Heidi Zak, you know, says in quotes, right now we're focused on category expansion, launching into new areas, and stable and efficient growth. There's no distinct timeline for going public, but that's the goal. So I do think they have their sights on their own IPO, which to me, I think is the right strategy. I mean, you look at the market cap of Victoria's Secret, you look at how big Victoria's Secret has gotten. And when you go public, you know, you do have different financial instruments and cords that you can pull that might, you know, help them expand internationally more efficiently and help them, you know, expand their brand. So, I mean, number one, I think Third Love is an incredible story. I mean, you know, you think about how they started and their slow start to where they've gotten to today. I mean, it is just incredible execution. But I think number two, they also have a lot of room to expand. You know, Victoria's Secret is really the Goliath in the industry. And I would like to see them lean into that. You know, I think they could do a lot of cool marketing stunts to further lean into that story. So, I mean, I'm excited for what the other marketing campaigns that they launch around.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I don't think an IPO would make sense. Or I guess I'll disagree with Heidi. Because when you IPO, okay, they're doing $200 million now. Let's suppose they get to 300 and then they decide to IPO. They'll IPO for $1.5-2 billion. Like that'll be the market cap. They're profitable, so they should be able to hold that value. But that size of an acquisition is not outside the realm of possibility for any of these other companies. And so you kind of put yourself at risk of being acquired by somebody you don't want to be acquired by, because you're a public company, they just buy your stock. And so there's an element here where they're almost, it's weird because the way the public markets are today is they're almost too small because everybody else that's public has such a big balance sheet that they may see, like, you know, the first time that the sales dip or the stock comes down, they're able to come in and you know, buy it. And it may not be what they want to do.
Yeah, that's a really good take. I mean, we'll see. I think IPO windows are opening up, you know, in the next few years. So I think if Third Love goes public, it will definitely be, you know, in the next, I would say 2 or 3 years, but maybe someone will buy them by then. We'll have to check into this on a future episode. What are your main takeaways from this story of Third Love? What stuck out to you?
Yeah, I think they focus on product, right? And really looking at your product as a point of differentiation versus marketing, right? Or versus brand. So they were very much product first, and then they built the brand because of the innovations that they were looking at in sizing. I think the personalization is world-class. The fact that they're able to basically eliminate returns to a large extent because they're so good at putting you in the right size bra to begin with, that's really remarkable. And then I think that there's a lot of lessons to be taken from the early missteps they had in their supply chain. And, you know, just finding someone to execute the strategy versus finding the right person to execute the strategy. And then I think it's interesting that they're partnering with Amazon to do all of their fulfillment.
I agree. And for those listening in, let us know what you think. Do you think Third Love should go public? Do you think they should, you know, sell to one of these larger conglomerates? What do you think their strategy should be? And I'm curious, you know, do you think they should expand internationally, or do you think they should focus on expanding into different product categories? So let Aaron and I know on LinkedIn and Twitter. We always reply to every comment. And thank you again for tuning in to this episode of E-commerce on Tap, brought to you by Sourcefy and ISBA. Please like, subscribe, comment. We really appreciate you tuning in. And Aaron and I look forward to hearing and seeing your comments shortly. Thank you.